Iran's top negotiator says the European signatories to the JCPOA have failed to come up with any initiatives to resolve differences over the removal of U.S. sanctions. Yemeni authorities say the battle for the province of Madhab is in its final stages. And a new poll shows more than half of Britons believe Prime Minister Boris Johnson should resign over a series of scandals involving him and his aides. Marzia Hashmi, thanks so much for being with us. Well, Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal are engaged in talks in Vienna, discussing the two draft documents Tehran presented last week. The proposals are about the removal of U.S. sanctions and the nuclear commitments Iran should fulfill, but differences remain over those two issues. That's according to Iran's lead negotiator, Ali Bagheri Kani. He says the European sides have failed to come up with any initiatives to resolve the differences.
What we have before us on the two issues that are currently on the agenda, one being the removal of the illegal and cruel U.S. sanctions, and the other being the nuclear measures, there have been various differences between the two sides. These differences are clearly visible in the final draft that was achieved following the sixth round of talks. The differences, especially on the nuclear issues, are numerous and varied. On these differences, we have not yet received any proposal or initiative from the other side, but we have ourselves presented the other side with our viewpoints based on our own modifications and proposals. Over the past few days, we have had various meetings at the level of experts and senior political directors, during which the modifications, viewpoints, and proposals of the Iranian side on the June 20th draft were discussed, and these discussions were positive and moving forward.
And yet another move against Iran. A U.S. House panel has passed a bill to restrict the proliferation of Iranian military drones. This is while negotiations over the removal of sanctions against the country are in progress in the Austrian capital, Vienna. Now, Tehran has time and again proven that its military prowess is purely defensive. So how can Washington's move be justified when the U.S. is selling bombs and drones to countries that use them in unjust wars to kill civilians?
On Friday, a bipartisan group of leading members of the U.S. House Committee on Foreign Affairs passed a bill aimed at restricting Iran's defensive military prowess. The Stop Iranian Drones Act would ban the supply, sale, or transfer of military drones to or from Iran under U.S. law. The bill addresses what the U.S. claims to be the growing threat of Iran's unmanned aerial vehicle program. However, despite gaining self-sufficiency in the arms industry by making great progress in developing and manufacturing a broad range of military equipment in recent years, Iran has time and again proven that its military capabilities are purely defensive in the face of moves by the U.S. and its regional allies, which have been fomenting chaos and tension in the region. Like last month, when the Iranian army intercepted two U.S. unmanned aerial vehicles that had penetrated the country's airspace, giving them a stern warning to stay away from the zone where it was holding massive drills. The ban imposed on the Iranian military drones comes amid ongoing talks over the removal of anti-Iran sanctions between Tehran and the signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal in Vienna. The U.S. has for long tried to tie Iran's military capabilities to the talks. However, the Islamic Republic has repeatedly underscored that its defensive capabilities will be never subject to negotiations. The U.S. also baselessly accuses Iran of conducting drone attacks in West Asia, while Washington has blood on its hands for killing thousands of innocent civilians by conducting drone and airstrikes in the region. Also, let's not forget that the United States is the leading exporter of arms in the world. Washington attempts to restrict Iran's defensive capabilities while it sells bombs, drones, and arms to other countries like Saudi Arabia that use them in unjust wars like the one in Yemen to kill innocent civilians. In fact, half of U.S. arms transfers between 2016 and 2020 went to West Asia region, particularly Saudi Arabia, leading to more instability and chaos. The U.S. is also guilty of civilian killings in many war theaters, like in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria, from drone strikes to other military action. Rights groups have accused Washington of hiding the real number of civilian casualties and underreporting them.
Well, the U.S. is responsible for massive civilian casualties that are the result of its drone strikes in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Syria, and other parts of the world. The U.S. also used the drone to assassinate Iran's top general Qasem Soleimani, a man who was the vanguard of fighting Daesh terrorists. That gives rise to the question whether the U.S. should be the country to face sanctions for its illegal use of drones.
Based on the U.S. military's own assertion, Washington has conducted almost 100,000 drone and air strikes in the West Asia region in the past 20 years, according to a new analysis published by the civilian harm monitoring group Air Wars. The U.S. strikes have killed at least 22,000 civilians across various theaters, including Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Somalia, Libya, Yemen, and Pakistan since 2001. The group says the number could probably be as high as 48,000. The U.S. also assassinated Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani, and Iraqi commander Abu Mehdi al-Mohandes in a drone strike near the Baghdad International Airport on January 3, 2020. The two were iconic figures in the fight against the Daesh terrorist group that emerged amid the mayhem resulting from the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. That's while top U.S. diplomats have previously admitted that Washington is responsible for the foundation of the Daesh terrorist group. Days after the Brazen Act, the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps launched a volley of missiles at a major military base housing American forces in Iraq. Iran denounced the assassination as a state terrorism and vowed to end the American presence in the region as the ultimate act of revenge.
Well, clearly, if one was going to have a completely honest and neutral legal international legal system, no country can stand above it. But we don't have that. And in fact, we have a system where the people who've got the arms and the money make the decisions. So obviously, if we were to say that any time a country used a drone and killed other civilians, there was going to be sanctions, clearly those countries that have drones, in particular this country, would have to be sanctioned. But that's simply not going to happen.
Well, the battle for the Yemeni province of Ma'arib has been ongoing for almost a year. Now, Yemen's deputy foreign minister says the war is in its final stages. Hossein al-Ezzi says security reasons and a resolve to uproot terrorism are the factors driving the push to liberate Ma'arib. The Ansarullah movement and forces loyal to Yemen's Saudi-backed former president have been engaged in heavy fighting for the control of the key province for almost a year. Ansarullah says the battle is now at a crucial stage. The army and fighters from popular committees have already managed to liberate several strategic locations, including a mountain range near the city of Ma'arib. The army says it has given militants and mercenaries a last chance to lay down their arms and surrender. Political commentator Hossein al-Bakhati says liberating the city of Ma'arib is important because Saudi Arabia and its mercenaries use it as a base to launch attacks on other parts of Yemen.
This is the final step as Hossein al-Ezzi, deputy Foreign Minister have said, because it has been really clearly in the last 1 year. We remember that the Saudi-backed forces were in the like in the outskirts of Sana'a, and now the Yemeni forces and popular committee are in the outskirts of Marib city. And as you see, the reason to liberate Marib city is because it has become the main base for Saudi war campaign against Yemen. And as well, Saudi has been gathering mercenary and terrorists from all around Yemen to Marib. And as well, they actually attack many areas in Yemen, either by terrorist attack or other type of attack from Marib. And as you see, that the war actually has not Saudi, even though we are seeing less airstrike on Yemen. It's not because that the Saudi are trying to avoid targeting civilians, but because their ability to launch hundreds of airstrikes a day, like they used to do, they cannot do it at this point, because Yemeni army has been targeted all Saudi air base, either south of Saudi Arabia or as well in all Saudis. That's why we say this less airstrike.
Meanwhile, Yemeni health officials are warning about an increasing number of infants with birth defects. They say the use of internationally prohibited weapons by the Saudi-led coalition has dramatically pushed up the cases of congenital anomalies. Our correspondent in Sana'a, Abdul Latif Al-Washatli, reports.
The tragedies caused by the Saudi-led war on Yemen are going beyond the casualties of airstrikes and an ongoing blockade. The Yemeni Pediatric Society says the number of infants with birth defects has increased rapidly since the 2015 war that turned Yemen into a testing ground for internationally banned weapons.
The weapons used by the Saudi-led coalition against our country contain prohibited chemicals that directly affect pregnant women and fetuses. That has increased the birth rate of children with cancer and congenital anomalies, especially in the areas that are being continuously bombed, such as Sana'a, Hudaydah, Hajjah, and Sada.
Officials say chemical and biological bombs dropped from Saudi warplanes on Yemenis have made Yemen the world's worst epidemic disaster. They're calling for an investigation into recent cases of congenital anomalies.
Since the first day of the aggression, the Saudi-led coalition has used various types of prohibited weapons, including cluster and phosphorus bombs, to target residential and agricultural areas. As a result of environmental contamination, we witnessed a dramatic rise of congenital malformations amongst children. We demand the documentation of the pathological cases caused by these bombs to reveal Saudi Arabia's war crimes.
Infants are suffering difficult condition in Yemen in the absence of essential medical supplies and healthcare facilities needed for their survival and well-being. Yemeni health centers have been in a dire situation since the start of the Saudi-led war.
As the war goes on, Yemeni children continue to be at the brunt of the death and destruction left behind by Saudi-banned weapons. People here believe that Riyadh has always been violating international law by using cluster munitions in bombing residential areas since it started its deadly war on Yemen. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Back-to-back scandals are taking their toll on the popularity of the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson and his ruling Conservative Party. An opinion poll shows support for Conservatives is down 4 points to 32%. That gives the opposition Labour a 9-point lead, their largest since 2014. Johnson's own ratings are also at their lowest since his party won a landslide in 2019. His popularity is 14% down in 2 weeks. More than half of voters also said he should resign. People are angry about parties at the Prime Minister's residence amid coronavirus lockdowns and the costly refurbishment of his residence. That's besides revelations that Johnson intervened to evacuate pets from Kabul during the chaotic Afghan withdrawal. His failed attempt to save a Tory lawmaker from suspension also drew a lot of criticism. Now turning to the United States, where dozens of devastating tornadoes roared through six states overnight on Friday. leaving scores of people dead. They destroyed homes, factories, and warehouses along a path that stretches hundreds of kilometers. Rescue workers and residents are still searching the rubble for survivors. Let's take a closer look in this report.
The U.S. is stunned by a devastating storm of tornadoes that ripped through the six states of Arkansas, Illinois, Kentucky, Missouri, Mississippi, as well as Tennessee overnight. Strong thunderstorms triggered dozens of tornadoes that crumbled metal like paper, swatted down concrete buildings, and threw a freight train off its track. Among notable casualties are a candle-making factory in Kentucky, a nursing home in Arkansas, and an Amazon warehouse in Illinois. An Illinois resident explains how he was shocked by the extent of damage after he rushed to his mother's house.
The damage is worse than some of the stuff I've seen in war pictures, so it's pretty intense. You know, it's not anything that I thought when she called me and told me that, oh, all my trees are gone. I was like, I got here and I did not expect to see this.
The town of Mayfield in Kentucky was described as ground zero by officials and appeared post-apocalyptic. A restaurant owner says the town's residents have lost it all.
It was just, this is our hometown, and it's just devastating. Everybody's lost everything.
Rescue workers across the middle of the country are combing through wreckage for survivors. Scores of deaths have already been confirmed, and officials warn that the toll is almost certain to rise as they are sifting through the ruins for the missing. President Joe Biden is going to travel to areas affected by what he's described as likely one of the largest tornado outbreaks in the American history.
I'm monitoring the situation very closely since early this morning. This is likely to be one of the largest tornado outbreaks in our history. And it's a tragedy. It's a tragedy.
President Biden also said he would task the environmental agencies to take a look at the specific impact climate change might have had on the deadly tornadoes. A meteorologist says he has rarely seen anything like this tornado storm during his career, spanning four decades.
I was watching the radar last night, and I was saying, wait a second. This is December. How is this happening in December? This is the kind of thing you would only see at the height of the season, you know, March, April, May. I'd never seen anything like this this time of year. I mean, and you hardly ever see something like this in a career.
The tornadoes have left a trail stretching around 370 kilometers. The multi-state disaster has freshened debates about whether climate change had a role to play in triggering these tornadoes, which are believed to be quite unseasonal, and whether a warmer planet would mean the world should expect to see more disasters of the kind.
Well, and with that, that brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin. Thanks so much for staying with us.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. Mehmet Sanko, president of the National Association of Immigration Judges, had declared herself mystified that Biden's Department of Justice would not negotiate with her members, despite the U.S. president vocally touting his purported support for workers' representation. We now present you an article written jointly by Alexander Villarreal and Joanna Walters. The piece is titled Victory for U.S. Immigration Judges as Biden Administration Recognizes Union. Stunning victory, U.S. immigration judges have settled a tense dispute with President Joe Biden's administration over their effort to restore union rights taken away from them under former President Donald Trump. Biden's Department of Justice agreed on Tuesday, 7th of December, to recognize the union as the exclusive representative for the nation's immigration judges and follow the terms of their collective bargaining agreement, at least for the time being. Days before reaching the settlement, the head of the Federal Immigration Judges Union had accused the Biden administration of doubling down on its predecessor's efforts to freeze out their association, even as they struggle with a backlog of almost 1.5 million court cases and staff shortages, which exacerbate due process concerns in their courts. Mimi Sankoff, president of the National Association of Immigration Judges, had declared herself mystified that Biden's Department of Justice would not negotiate with her members, despite the U.S. president vocally and frequently touting his purported support for workers' representation. Mimi Sankoff said before the settlement, "This administration has really doubled down on maintaining the Trump position that we are not a valid union." Sankoff was appointed as an immigration judge back in 2006 and is based in New York, where she also teaches at Fordham University School of Law. She spoke to The Guardian only in her union role. After what she described as decades of relatively smooth relations between the National Association of Immigration Judges and the Department of Justice, former U.S. President Donald Trump capped 4 years of right-wing immigration policy by successfully petitioning to strip hundreds of immigration judges of their right to unionize. The hostile move was decided by the Federal Labor Relations Authority, an independent administration federal agency that controls labor relations between the federal government and its employees, on 2nd of November 2020, the day before the presidential election. Despite a Democratic victory and Joe Biden taking the White House, pledging to undo damage done by Donald Trump, the union remained shut out and silenced for more than a year, without a date set to hear its case attempting to restore its official status. Mimi Sankoff said, "I cannot understand it, working together, as the president has claimed, working with federal employees, working with unions, achieves better results." The Justice Department did clear the way in June for the judges' union to at least ask for its rights back when the Executive Office for Immigration Review, home of the country's immigration courts, withdrew opposition to the National Association of Immigration Judges' motion for reconsideration. However, Mimi Sankoff said the administration has still been refusing to negotiate, which led the National Association of Immigration Judges to accuse the Executive Office of Immigration Review of unfair labor practices. The complaint in question accused the Executive Office of Immigration Review of interfering with, restraining and coercing employees in the exercise of their rights to organize and refusing to negotiate in good faith. She said in a telephone interview recently, "Good faith in my mind would have said if we really cared about this union, this administration would have started negotiating with us, but they haven't, so we're really mystified as to why." She added, "I don't think there's any other way to say it. They have simply doubled down on this policy, and it is counterintuitive given the positions that the president has set forth. In a formal response to the complaint, the Executive Office for Immigration Review stated that, in essence, the National Association of Immigration Judges is defunct. Administration officials went so far as to file a motion to dismiss the National Association of Immigration Judges' grievances about unfair labor practices, though the motion was denied. But on Tuesday, 7th of December, the U.S. administration changed its tune, agreeing to recognize the union and make other concessions in exchange for the National Association of Immigration Judges withdrawing its charges of unfair labor practices. The administration will continue to recognize the union unless the FLRA denies the motion for reconsideration. The Executive Office for Immigration Review does not comment on continuing litigation. Even with the conflict reaching a detente, the nation's immigration courts are still tackling crushing caseloads, with severe shortages of vital personnel such as legal assistants and translators. Mimi Sankoff said one of the New York immigration courts only had about 30% of the staff it needs, and other courts in cities as geographically diverse as Memphis, Salt Lake City, and Philadelphia have been short of staff for years. The lack of personnel makes it more difficult for judges to be fully prepared for hearings and can even affect whether those in front of the courts, often including migrants at the U.S.-Mexico border, receive adequate notice of important changes to their cases. She suggested the shifting political priorities between administrations might have focused resources on law enforcement instead of hiring more staff to make the immigration courts run more efficiently. Mimi Sankoff said, "It is a very real impact on the ability of respondents who are seeking justice to ensure that they're receiving a fair hearing." Meanwhile, migration advocates have warned the Biden administration's move to revive the former U.S. President Donald Trump's Remain in Mexico policy will subject thousands of people to enormous suffering and leave them vulnerable to kidnap and abuse as they languish in dangerous Mexican border cities. After reaching a deal with Mexico, the United States will start returning asylum seekers from other Latin American countries to Mexico, where they will be obliged to wait while their case is being assessed. Under the policy first implemented by Donald Trump, asylum seekers were left stranded in violent Mexican border cities, where they were routinely targeted by organized crime groups for rape, robbery, extortion, and abduction. The U.S. government is promising to improve the scheme to allow asylum seekers legal representation and to conclude their claims within 6 months of an individual's initial return to Mexico. Mexico claimed U.S. officials met its concerns over funding for migrant shelters, protection for vulnerable groups, and access to medical checkups and COVID-19 vaccines. It also promised to take local safety conditions into account before accepting asylum seekers, a pledge that provoked disquiet among migrant advocates. But advocates argue that the main shortcomings of the program are unchanged.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture, everyone. In the first part, we saw how Lorna Tychatsu made her first trip to Iraq just before the start of the war to reveal the humanity of Iraq's citizens through her photojournalism. Consequently, her attempt to enlighten the American public turned to controversy as Fox News broadcasters called her efforts, quote, villainous and even bordering on treason, and accused her of aiding and abetting the enemy on the brink of war. But Lorna was never intimidated by such words. Instead, she continued her efforts to report stories that go beyond mainstream media coverage, and during her trips to Iraq, she endeavors to get as close to the people as possible and find her way to the ordinary people in the streets of Iraq. Well, stay with us for the second part of our documentary.
It appears that there were not weapons of mass destruction there.
You said you knew where they were.
I did not. I said I knew where suspect sites were, and
you
we
said,
were just...
You said you knew where they were, near Tikrit, near Baghdad, and north, east, south, and west of there. Those are your words.
We flew back, and we spent 6 weeks living in an unprotected hotel, talking to as many Iraqis as possible, traveling in taxi cabs and in people's cars, people who started to befriend us after a while. This particular camp kind of adopted me because I would keep going back. A lot of journalists go to Iraq, they get the story, they go home, they write about it, they never go back. These people, I usually go visit everyone. I try and visit everyone I've spoken to, like, you know, different people who I've had conversations with on each trip to see how they're doing, get a recap. They invited me to their eldest son's wedding, and this was wild. I mean, we had my interpreter and I and the videographer arrived at this SWAT camp. And all these women were all dolled up in this back room, and they put the Arabic music on, and they have the kerchiefs, and we're doing the dance, and we're just having like this blast. The Iraqi people are good-looking people. They love to look good. They're very fashionable. This is in a SWAT camp. These people are obviously very poor, but they're still, if they have only one set of clothes, they wash it every night. They go out, and they love to look good. Happiest when I'm there, you know, really, because you know you're doing your work. I feel like you're making some progress. You're helping the world a little bit.
Don't you think this building needs some love?
Yeah.
It's a big surprise. He's
90 years old. He's still working.
I think of those young and old people who we've impacted each other. They've taught me so much about their culture, about life in Iraq. They've allowed me an insider's glimpse.
I really had a great day. You will never believe the miracle that happened. We were waiting for a taxi across the street from the hotel. Suddenly, this taxi rolled slowly over to us, as if by magic. And the guy driving was the man in the photo walking with crutches with one leg. And he remembered me taking his photo, so we made arrangements for him to come to the hotel and see his picture. Did you know that at the last minute, I grabbed my box of huge 20 by 24 photos? Yes, and I did have them here with me, and I can show people the photos. I gotta go now. My battery got fried yesterday when the electricity came on. I had no surge protector hooked to it. Much love to you, my sweetie. I'm missing you all the day long and talking to you in my heart. I miss you and love you very much. Love, Muma.
I have Commando Mommy photos, Liz. Where? I'm looking for them right now.
Commando.
We went over to Ala's house and they wrapped me in a...
I want to be your president for four more years to make our future brighter and better for every one of our citizens. I want to be your president for four more years to make our country safe.
The Republican message is going to be, these are dangerous times, and President Bush will protect you.
If we are a representative democracy and we supposedly have control over our government, what are we going to do about it?
Attendance is estimated between 100,000 and 300,000 people, though no official figures have been released. Overall, the march, peaceful, except for some altercations. So far, police report 134 arrests.
2005, I went back for the first election, and I almost got killed a couple of times. I was only actually in the country for 10 days, and I didn't go back for a couple of years because I was terrified. I was caught in a crossfire shootout. And, you know, here I am, an unarmed American woman traveling, you know, with cameras. And I would think, I must have been crazy coming here and walking on these streets. Every night at the hotel, darkness would come and you'd hear, like, the machine gun fire out in the street or handgun fire out in the street. Or sometimes they were, like, fighting each other. I don't know what was going on. Everywhere we went, there were guns. You can hear, like, them clicking the guns in the background. They're loading them, checking the clips. There's nothing like the sound of a Kalashnikov being loaded.
It was kind of like, oh, attitude. You're not killing us today. And if you want to kill us, go ahead. Try. It was like, it was so intense. Like, gunfire broke out at one point, and no one left. Like, people refused to move, even though there was someone was shooting a gun at them. They told us, like, we went to the first polling place. They said, no, you cannot take any pictures of the National Guard or the police. So, yes, I'm not going to break the rules. Soon, everybody wants me to take their picture. The policeman in charge, he said, here, take my picture. He took someone's kid. He was kissing the kid. He said, I want you to take my picture.
Now, remember, this last trip was very dangerous for me. I had to wear hijab the entire time and my abaya. My camera bag was a hidden woman's bag where I had, you know, and I had a press pass. I was even afraid to show that at times that someone would take me out. There were over 250 political parties. Here's the election ballot boxes. People came in, they voted. And that's the other thing. A lot of political parties suddenly were popping out of the woodwork, you know, because, oh, now we have democracy. Do we know what that means? Now we have freedom. Do we know what that means? I mean, it was a very beautiful, exciting time to see these people emerging from this snuffed-out dictatorship state to be just thinking about, now we're free. The first 3 weeks there, I didn't talk. I didn't write a word. I was too afraid to, because I had to get my mind on it. I had to wrap my mind around it, and I had to open to what they were saying and not what I was feeling, or not what I went there thinking.
No one is interested in the truth. So did I want to hear that half the people in Iraq were, you know, certainly large numbers of people love Bush? No, I didn't want to hear that.
We are no killers. We are no terrorists. We are just looking for peace and beautiful life.
So what do you think should happen now? I had two choices. I could have submerged myself and refused to hear them and to seek out people who supported my belief system, or I could listen to what they were saying and try to understand why they were saying it. And that's what I decided to do. And it was painful, and it was hard, and it was shocking to me. But the bottom line is, it's very complex. In fact, the first article I wrote was called Making Peace with All the Truths. It's not one truth. It's a multifaceted truth. And it may not make sense, and it's not black and white, and it's not right or wrong. It is complicated. But, you know, it doesn't fit into a sound bite, so we can't use it. And that's where I'm at. I don't know what I'm going to do. All I kept thinking the last 3 weeks I was there is I want to come home and plant my garden. Politics, the world, war.
Knowing what you know today, would you do the same thing all over again?
I think it is doubtful that without the weapons of mass destruction case, the President, the Congress, the United Nations, and those who joined us in the conflict, the British, the Italians, the Spanish, the Australians, would have found a persuasive enough case to support a decision to go to war.
I want our troops home. I want all this. I want all the children of the world home and not in a war situation, okay? But we can't get the troops home now because we've opened up Pandora's box and people's lives are at risk. And it's about time. I mean, the left doesn't want to take responsibility for anything. The right doesn't want to take responsibility. We have to take responsibility. As an American, I have to take responsibility in my country. And I'm not going to abandon these people who I have gotten to know and who are telling me we're afraid that if you guys leave, the shit's going to hit the fan.
You classify your work, journalism, as anti-mainstream or alternative.
I don't think they have a category for me in. I went to Iraq to bring home the face of the Iraqi people so that the people in my country could see who they were killing and maybe think, these are beautiful people, why would we want to kill them? Infantile idealism.
As a journalist, what are you going to do? Are you prepared for dying?
You can't go there unless you accept that you may not.
My name is Lorna Tychostop. I'm an editor, writer, and photojournalist. I've been working in and out of Iraq now since February 2003. I'm going to continue to name the names of the fallen from the state of New Mexico. Specialist Christopher A. Merville, age 26. Sergeant Moses Daniel Rocca, age 19.
The first time I read, the first 19-year-old, I had to like wait a whole minute because I didn't want to. You know, I had a
Private, first class, William C. Ramirez, age 19.
Sergeant Tommy L. Gray, age 34. Jaffer Hashim Majid, age 13. Wissam Hadi Duari, age 11. Daoud Kiss, age 55. Muhammad Agab, no age given.
This is exactly where my photos belong, because people will see them.
Ahmed Al Rifai, age 13.
The face of the Iraqi people has found a home.
At some point, I realized I didn't know enough to truly report in depth on the issues that I was learning about. So I went back to school. I found a master's program at NYU in global affairs. And by that time, I had begun doing consulting work for an Iraqi NGO called Nature Iraq. Their work was to baseline the environmental conditions in the country while violence was still occurring. And I just thought that was phenomenal, and I chose that as my thesis topic. I graduated at the end of 2009, and shortly thereafter scored, you know, what I thought was my dream job, and working as a communications and outreach specialist for a USAID project in Baghdad. Their work had to do with training over 100,000 Iraqi civil servants in how to rebuild their country.
For nearly 9 years, our nation has been at war in Iraq. I'm proud to finally say these two words, and I know your families agree. Welcome home. Welcome home.
You know, my son called me a couple of days after 9/11 and said, hey, Mom, me and Mikey, we're going to sign up. We're going to go get them. And I was like, get who? As my, you know, heart stopped. And he said, we're going to get them, the people who did this. And I said, well, who did this? We don't know who did this. Who are you going to go get? Don't you think you should wait till we know who did this before you go get them? Sometimes I think I'm the one who went, so they wouldn't have to. Because I would rather it be me than them. I think I put a lot of faces where people had friendly, happy family faces to what people previously thought of as terrorists and scary and dark. And I think I was able to show a lot of people that, you know, we're not that much different. We all want basically the same things. We want a nice job so we can have a nice vacation. We want dinner on the table with our family at the end of the day. And we want to live in peace.
Lorna's haunting photographs and poignant stories enable her audience to share the tragedy, the struggle, the triumph of the Iraqi people. And they raise larger questions about the war, a war that was never necessary, which could have been stopped if only the warmongering governments heard the voice of the people. And that's it, everyone, for this week on Aperture. Until another episode right here on Aperture, goodbye. Thank you.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.